VY.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Poor inner-city unwed fathers are often viewed with disdain for shirking the responsibilities of parenthood and marriage. Our guests Catherine Eden and Timothy Nelson spent a decade interviewing 110 black and white single dads in poor neighborhoods in Philadelphia and Camden to, quote, understand why so many ultimately fail to be the fathers they aspire to be. That quote is from their new book, Doing the Best I Can. They paint a complex picture of fatherhood that challenges some of those deadbeat dad stereotypes. What they found were teens and young men who wanted to be good fathers, but often didn't have the psychological skills or financial stability to live up to those responsibilities. Their relationship with the baby's mother was often fragile and fraught. I'm happy to say that Catherine Eden and Timothy Nelson join us here in our Philadelphia studio. Catherine Eden is a professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, and nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
Also with us, as I said, Timothy Nelson. He's a lecturer in social policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. And Tim, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
Kathy, let me begin with you. I think the last time you were on our show many, many years ago, you were the co-author of a book, Promises I Can Keep, Why Poor Women Put Motherhood Before Marriage. Is this book looking at the other side of that relationship, the poor dads?
Yeah, so Maria Kafalis and I published that book in 2005, and people kept saying to us, you've been writing about single mothers, what about the dads? And I said, well, I don't need to interview the dads. I know that story. And, of course, as soon as we did start talking to the dads, we realized we didn't.
You didn't?
We didn't know the story.
Because you hadn't really talked to them? You hadn't established kind of relationship where you could learn about their lives?
Well, we knew, we'd been talking to the moms, so we knew the mom's side of the story. And we knew what the mom said about the dads. But the dads have their own story, and in order to understand the whole picture of what's going on in low-income communities, you really do have to talk to both moms mm-hmm. and dads.
Well, in fact, Tim, you and Kathy moved to Camden, New Jersey, just across the river here, in part to get to know some of these dads.
Yeah, that's how we started out. We kind of moved into East Camden and just began to get a feel for the neighborhood, just to, you know, kind of get what that experience is like and build up some idea of what we would want to ask these fathers once we got in contact with them.
So here you are, two white academics moving into East Camden. What did they think of you?
Well, it's interesting. I found people to be really open, and you know, once we started contacting fathers and starting to talk to them, I was amazed at how they opened up to me. I think, you know, often these guys just don't really have anyone to talk to, and these experiences, particularly about fatherhood, are so meaningful to them that they really want to share. They really want to, you know, to tell their story.
And I'm curious about, I mean, you're talking to your strangers, at least initially, having someone to feel so comfortable to be able to talk about some of this intimate and in many ways painful thing.
Yeah. So I think that's the reason that living in Camden was so important. I mean, we did interview both white and black fathers, but of course we're white, so it was harder to bridge the gap with the African-American fathers. And, you know, in some sense, realizing that the Maytag repairman won't come to your house and that the Philadelphia Inquirer isn't delivering to the local convenience store because the drivers are afraid to come into the neighborhood, and that we have two daughters, and that you can't go with your toddler to the car without holding both of her hands so she doesn't pick up a dirty needle on the mm-hmm. sidewalk. Those kinds of shared experiences, I think, kind of wore away the unfamiliarity and gave us something in common to talk about.
In part talking about the difficulty of living in East Camden?
The difficulty of living in East Camden, exactly. We lived just two blocks from Westfield Acres, which has now been demolished. You know, Camden's earliest and most notorious housing project. And you know, we hung out and spent time and shared meals and did ordinary things, and that really helped.
And what did you want to know? I mean, bottom line, what did you want to know?
I think what we wanted to know at first is, why were there so many deadbeat dads? So we started out with kind of the wrong question, because we know now from survey research that 80% of these dads show up at the hospital when their kids are born. 80% of the moms and the dads think they're going to stay together. About half are living together when the kids are born. So what we wanted to know, I think, was part of the problem. And hanging around allowed us to change the question to, well, if men's intentions are so good, if they're so committed to staying involved, why doesn't it work out that way?
Right. You tell the story of a number of men. You probably changed their names, but there's a 15-year-old named Andre. Andre finds out that his ex-girlfriend is pregnant, and his response is, "Thank you, Jesus." He's 15 years old.
Mm. Yeah, so he was actually one of the first young men we spoke with, and coming in with that assumption that, you know, I think a lot of people have, that these guys are just after sex, and as soon as she comes up pregnant, then he denies paternity or he sort of takes off. And for him to tell this story, and what's interesting about that story is that was his reaction in private. Around his aunt and his mother, he was sort of all, you know, acting all angry and upset, and what am I going to do? But secretly, as he tells us the story, he is overjoyed that he's going to become a father. And so that was our first sort of clue that this was a whole different story than we had anticipated.
And what did father, or what does, what did fatherhood mean to Andre?
Well, for Andre, growing up in East Camden, in a very troubled neighborhood and with a very troubled family, he had just lost an older brother to street violence, and his mom had been in and out of crack addiction and so on. So for Andre, the chance to be a father was something positive in the midst of all the negativity around him, the drugs and the violence and all of that. So that's how he perceived it.
He perceived it in terms of a relationship, Kathy?
Yeah, so when he said this, when he told us this story about going up to his room, acting all angry and slamming the door and then sort of looking around, pausing, and then dancing around the room, shouting, "Thank you, Jesus," you know, we sort of said, "Wait a minute, what was going through your mind?"
And mm-hmm. And he's 15,
right? And when fathers like Andre say, "Thank you, Jesus," what they're really thinking, number one, is, "I don't want to be like my dad.
I don't want to be like my dad.
I have a chance to do something different." And there really is a sea change in the culture of fatherhood in these low-income neighborhoods. We were in Camden yesterday with some of these dads, and Joe White, one of the guys there, who we've known for many years, said, "You know, nowadays, if you just have children and you don't do anything for them, you're pariah." You know, it's really interesting. There's a strong social pressure to be engaged with your kids, and there's the sense of joy, not in the status of being a father. It's not like some mark of masculinity, but it's really about a role, mm-hmm. and it's about a chance to be generative and to love.
And that, I mean, that's a view of fatherhood I think you can see across the culture, across classes, the idea that fathers are more than just breadwinners. These are people that are important players in their children's lives.
That's right. So since the 70s, you know, really spurred by feminism, the new father movement has gotten men into the nursery and into housework. They're more involved with their kids than they ever have been before. I think we've known this about middle-class men, and we know that middle-class men have now paired breadwinning with nurturing. We didn't know this was happening among lower-class men. Hmm. And indeed, what lower-class men are doing is almost an exaggerated version of that. They're almost saying, "Well, I can't really be a paycheck. I certainly can't be a 50% provider. But I can be a nurturer, and isn't that more important?" Hmm. And so they're actually privileging the softer side of fatherhood, sometimes to the anger and disgust of their children's mothers. And that's the problem. That's where the gender battle is. He says, "Hey, I want to be like a mom." And she says, "What have you done for me lately financially?"
Let me pick up on that, Tim, because, I mean, it sounds like what you're describing are, quote-unquote, middle-class values about mm-hmm. fatherhood, but without the middle-class income.
Yeah, so they're emphasizing the part of fatherhood they feel they can actually accomplish. So, you know, the men that we talked to are all low-income men. So they were really struggling to make it from week to week. They might be in work one week, out of work the next week. And what's interesting is if you ask them about what's the right way to do fatherhood, they say, "Well, you should stay in school, you should get married, and then when you're financially stable, then you should have children." So it's not that they have a different value system and that sort of thing. It's just that they don't feel like they can accomplish what they know is the right path.
Because what often happens is the reverse, right? The children mm-hmm. come first. And I mean, the children don't come at the end of that. They often
right.
become in
but
the beginning.
But they still aspire to marriage. They still aspire to, and a lot of them eventually get there. Maybe later on, after they've had a few children, they'll get the stable job. They'll get this, you know, the stable relationship and eventually marry.
This is the birth control question. I mean, does the issue of birth control ever come up? How do people get pregnant, knowing, of course, that there is, you know, almost everywhere a way of using birth control?
This is a crucial part of the story. So usually these young men and women don't know each other very well. They meet locally on the stoop, at the South Street Strip, Penn's Landing, the kinds of places around Philly and Camden that you meet people. And they do use contraception at the beginning. But as the relationship sort of turns into something a little more serious, what we call the together phase, they're mm-hmm. not really in a real relationship, but they want to signal this is an exclusive, a sexually exclusive relationship, condom use ceases. Because if you continue to use condoms, it's like saying to your partner, I think you're cheating on me.
Oh.
So suddenly, no condoms. And sure enough, she turns up pregnant. So the modal number of months before a pregnancy, between sort of first being, talking to each other and a pregnancy leading to a live birth is only 6 to 7 months. Mm. So the typical story is a unintended pregnancy, but not a pregnancy that was adamantly avoided. It was sort of, most men say, well, I was just not thinking at the time.
Well, in fact, I think the word you use in the book, Tim, is semi-planned.
That's right. And I think it's important once, as Kathy said, once they stop using condoms, and we asked men explicitly about this, so they would tell us the stories. But they never actually explicitly have the conversation with their partner about the ceasing of birth control. So we kind of characterize it as a don't ask, don't tell approach to birth control. And each of them are kind of then thinking, well, I guess we're taking a risk here. And I think part of the dynamic of that is these guys know they're not in the best of circumstances to have a child. So, but they also really want one. So it's kind of a way for them to deal with that ambiguity by not having that explicit conversation and quote unquote mm-hmm. taking a risk. And that's why when you ask them if your child was planned, they say, well, I knew we were taking a risk, so that's why I call it semi-planned.
Well, we're almost having a break here. You could also call that denial, couldn't you, Kathy?
I think what we tend to miss as middle-class folks who have so much in our lives is how strong the thirst for children can be. It's not as if fathers sort of plan to get pregnant by accident. It's more that they don't want enough to avoid a pregnancy. So when it comes, it's welcomed.
And that's Catherine Eden, who joins us along with Timothy Nelson. I should say that they are a married couple and have written a book called Doing the Best I Can, Fatherhood in the Inner City, based on interviews that they have done here in Philadelphia and in Camden, New Jersey. In fact, lived in Camden for a while to do those interviews. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Mann Center and AEG Live support WHYY. This Sunday, June 16th, female ensemble Celtic Woman sing traditional Irish music alongside live dancers, pipers, and drummers. Also coming to The Mann, Joan Baez and Indigo Girls together in concert on June 20th. Tickets and information for Celtic Woman, Joan Baez, and Indigo Girls at The Mann online at manncenter.org and ticketmaster.com.
Coming to WHYY's Hamilton Public Media Commons, our popular Young Journalist Summer Camp for students in grades 9 through 12. Learn from the staff of WHYY's renowned news department, create video news stories, and work with the media instructors of the award-winning Hamilton Commons. Learn all aspects of production, interviewing, shooting and editing video, and more. Two-week sessions start June 24th and August 5th. RSVP at whyy.org/camps.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Charlie Wilson made hits in the 80s as the frontman of the Gap Band. In the 90s, he was homeless on the streets of Los Angeles. Then, he turned it back around.
And everybody was like looking at me like I was kind of crazy. It's like, at this age, come on, man. You know, "You're not serious, are you?" I was like, "I did not finish doing what I was doing."
Charlie Wilson of the Gap Band for the next Bullseye from NPR.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Catherine Eden and Timothy Nelson. We're talking about the stereotype of the poor urban deadbeat dad. It's an enduring stereotype. They moved into Camden, New Jersey a number of years ago to talk with young fathers about how they view the roles and responsibilities of parenthood. What they found was complex, and it's what they write about in their new book called Doing the Best I Can, Fatherhood in the Inner City. Timothy Nelson, a lecturer in social policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, and Catherine Eden, a professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Thinking about these dads, what kinds of economic, I mean, looking at you, Kathy, what kind of economic opportunities do they have? Have they finished high school, for instance? Do they have the kinds of skills that could allow them to make a living?
Well, this is a really interesting part of the story. In Philadelphia, deindustrialization hit maybe 20 years before most cities. I mean, we began to deindustrialize here in the 1950s. In Camden, there was wholesale deindustrialization in the 70s with the loss of Campbell's Soup, by and large, and RCA and some of the shipyards. So Kensington, the workshop of the world, largely absent of any industry today. So working class America in Philadelphia changed dramatically, it really left these men behind. So these are the neighborhoods we went to. And men do work when they can. Sometimes they work in the informal economy, sometimes in the underground economy. Usually they're trying to get a legitimate job. But it's hard, and it's becoming harder as the low-wage labor market is changing. Fewer and fewer jobs offer full-time hours, stable employment. So it's really hard to be an unskilled man.
And I wonder, too, Tim, you talked to 110 men, but how many of them involved in drugs, for instance, or how many have criminal records?
Well, unfortunately, in Camden and Philadelphia, the majority of the men we talked to, and again, these are both white and African-American men, had been involved in the drug trade at some point in their lives. By the time we talked to them, and again, we interviewed half of the people we talked to were under the age of 30 and half over the age of 30. So some of that was a while in their past. And only a few people we talked to were still sort of going back to that illegal drug trade.
But they had done it for a while.
But they had done it. And a lot of them, did have criminal records.
Because of drugs.
That. Mm-hmm.
And drug addiction as well. So this is partly an artifact of where we did the study, but it's not unusual in other cities as well. Drugs are a huge problem. It's usually a brief phase in the life course for many men. They soon learn, as they say, that slow money is sure money. They want to transition out of the drug trade and get a legitimate job, but it's very, very hard to do. So most do make that transition, but it's a painful one that involves financial sacrifice.
Do they think about their future?
They do. Here's the thing, though. Leaving the drug trade may mean that you can't provide for your kids in the way that you had when you were on the corner.
You had mentioned, and we shouldn't forget the women, and you
wrote
a book
about
the women, but this is a relationship. And as I read through your book, and you describe a lot of these men and their relationships with the women in their lives, these are tough relationships. I mean, it seems like it's hard to have a relationship even under the best of circumstances. And these are challenging circumstances.
Yeah, so in the middle class, typically, a pregnancy is an outgrowth of a relationship. Right, it's a symbol of a relationship. In these inner city communities, the relationship was an outgrowth of an unintended pregnancy. So you have young people who aren't very compatible. They don't know each other very well. They decide they're going to make a relationship around the baby. There's great enthusiasm, tremendous pressure. And often, both the man and the woman are chiefly concerned about forging a bond with the baby. So one thing that characterizes these relationships is they're all about the baby. And when men are telling themselves, well, she would be nice to have in my life, but it's really that child, men often underinvest in the mom-dad relationship, and they don't straighten up in the ways that they need to in order to make that relationship work.
Does that create resentments? I mean, I would think it would.
Yeah, yeah. And but in likewise, the moms are really all about the babies, and the moms are saying, you know, this child is mine. So there's a sense in which the men are trying to sort of claim a piece of a child that a woman sees as hers, and there's a lot of conflict around that.
You want to add to that, Tim?
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, in contrast to how it was decades ago when there was much more shotgun marriage, you know, which was an artifact of the social pressures for the couple to get married in the face of an unexpected pregnancy. What was really interesting to us was to discover actually the opposite of that now. So when these couples are pregnant, his mother and extended family might say, well, are you really sure this child's yours? You know, there's a lot of mistrust on that side. And on her side and her mother and extended family, why are you dealing with this guy? He's trifling. He's got no prospect. So there's nobody really for these couples. Mm-hmm. And in the face of dealing with parenting a newborn and all the financial pressures and so on, it's no surprise, actually, that these relationships are so fragile.
You know, Kathy, I remember interviewing you on this book, A Promises I Can Keep, Why Poor Women Put Motherhood Before Marriage. And one of the lasting memories I have of that interview is that these poor mothers had a kind of romantic notion about marriage. I mean, almost fairy tale notion about marriage. And of course, marriage is really hard, and you know, there are no fairy tale marriages. Is that true for men as well? I mean, do they have this Hollywood view of marriage, the old style Hollywood, not the current?
So we asked one guy, Ernest, about marriage, and his story is fascinating. You know, he'd been talking about the trials and tribulations that he's having with the mother of his 10-year-old, and you know, this is the woman he'd been trying to get it together with for the sake of the child. And when you ask Ernest about marriage, he said, and what does marriage require? He says, well, that requires crazy, insane love, like you wait under her window in the rain until her light comes on. So yes, but when you really unpack what men mean by that,
right,
what they're really looking for is someone who won't reject them. Ultimately, they don't think they can find a woman they can trust, and part of the reason for that is their circumstances can be so bad, you know, they're afraid that no woman would really stick with them given how precarious their lives are. So they're really looking for trust, and that's why the crazy, insane love is required.
Well, and even picking up on the dad idea, and I'm thinking about these dads that you interviewed, Tim, mm-hmm. about their relationships with their dads.
Right.
I mean, I think we hear much too often about these kind of fatherless families, or even families where boys are just sort of hungry for some kind of relationship with their fathers.
Yeah, a lot of, as Kathy said, a lot of the times the first thing that goes through a young man's mind when he finds out he's going to become a father is, I don't want to be like my own father, who often wasn't around, very disconnected from his own life. And a lot of the guys are very distressed to see that despite those intentions, the same thing is happening to them. And so they are not able, despite the best of intentions, to try to turn that around.
Is it because they don't have the kind of models? I mean, I think that this happens mm-hmm. well, again at all levels of life.
Yeah, and it's also because what they realize, it's not entirely up to them. I mean, there's the economic situation. There's also the fact when the couple breaks up, you know, the mom may start keeping him away from the child, and there's a lot of dynamics in that Kathy can talk to
sure.
about.
Go ahead,
so,
Kathy, then we'll get to our colleague.
One of the best predictors of whether a father will stay involved with his child is whether a mom takes on a new partner. And what we learned through sort of talking to both the moms and the dads is the woman's really tempted when she meets a new guy to give that guy the title of father. It's easier. It's part of how he proves to her that he's a good guy. And so gatekeeping often starts when that happens. And so dads can be shut out.
That's Catherine Eden, who joins us along with Timothy Nelson. We're talking about their new book based on about 10 years of research here in Philadelphia and in Camden, New Jersey, across the river. The book is called Doing the Best I Can, and it's subtitled Fatherhood in the Inner City. And again, they spent about 10 years living in part in Camden, New Jersey, and also doing lots of interviews with 110 black and white poor fathers. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Give us a call. Let's see what Mark from Germantown has to say. Mark, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, Ms. Mark Wayne, and good morning to your guests.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was one of your callers back in 2005.
Really?
When Ms. Eden and Ms. Cathalis brought out Promises I Can Keep, and I asked them specifically at the time, had they considered interviewing the fathers, and I mentioned by name Professor Lionel Tiger over at Rutgers.
Oh, yeah.
Who wrote a book back in 2000 called The Decline of Males.
Right.
And at the time, I could tell I kind of caught them both flat-footed because they kind of, you know, had a stutter step in their response.
You have a good memory, Mark.
So, yeah. And so my question, and I'm very, very glad that you guys have done this research now, but my question to the both of you is this. I know that y'all focus on questioning the whole hit and run deadbeat.
Yeah, Mark, can you talk into your phone receiver there? It's we're getting kind of a muffled sound. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I know y'all both question the kind of whole notion of deadbeat dad and what have you. But I wanted to know if y'all also examine what I call the Mari question. That is to say, you know, the daytime talk show host Mari Povich has for many years, more like two decades now, focused on these paternity question shows.
Okay.
And that's a huge area of concern. Whether or not we agree or disagree with, you know, the nature of the show or whatnot, it just tells me that the enduring nature of the show over more than 20 years tells me that it's a huge area of concern.
Well, Mark, let me take your point.
For whatever reason, doesn't really get scholarly examination.
I hear you. This is not the Mari Povich show. I just want our listeners to know that. But just picking up on his comment, is paternity an issue? I mean, is this something that you found from your work, Kathy?
You know, on the 95 in Kensington, there used to be a billboard that said 1-800-DNA, who is the father? So it can be an issue, and sometimes men and women, this is because men and women aren't really often together in a stable relationship when pregnancy ensues. But not that many men deny paternity. In our study, about 9% say they've denied paternity for one child. And if we find more evidence, actually, of overclaiming of men that have negative paternity tests but insist that the child must be theirs and remain involved despite it. So in general, this is a concern, but it's not as if men are trying to evade responsibility. They're trying to embrace it in most cases.
Picking up on something that you, and I want to talk about the children, because if we're talking about parents, we need to be sure to focus on the children. And what you say in this book, Tim, is that in many ways they end up having a relationship with their child or children more like the favorite uncle.
Yeah, so the bottom line of the dynamic is that, as Kathy said, the men have this father thirst. They really want to be connected to their kids. And as the relationship with the mom becomes disrupted, and then often the relation with the child from that mom becomes disrupted, then, you know, they're going to find a new relationship and also a new pregnancy and a new child. And so they often become engaged in what we call serial selective fathering. Mm-hmm. In other words, if they're locked out of one kid's life, they're gonna try again with another. But they still, you know, are still in tough economic circumstances. They still can't provide 50% of what the children need. And so they do the best they can. That's where the title of the book came from. And often that means providing more symbolic goods for their kids, which are going to, as they say, invest in the relationship rather than, you know, paying the light bill and these other kind of things, which are often invisible to kids.
But I guess I worry about this, you know, the repeating cycle. So if you have, in case boys, whose dad is not you know, entirely involved in their life, and then, you know, then the next generation. Are there, do you have some of these generational concerns about fathers and fatherhood and boys?
Yeah, I think one of the things our study revealed is that if you look at most of these dads will say they're good dads, and the reason they'll tell you they're good dads is they're actively involved in at least one of their children's lives, typically at any given time, right? So as they engage in this sort of try again fathering, they're slaking this father thirst, but they are leaving. Yeah. Their children behind, right? Now, some people say, well, we shouldn't try to connect fathers with kids because they'll just leave. But what we haven't recognized is that if we don't connect a dad or help connect a dad with kid A, there's going to be kid B. And there may be kid C. So this is a new way of thinking about fatherhood. You know, if we accept the premise that fathers are wanting to be generative and that they will continue to try, then we have that requires a very different policy response.
What would that policy look like?
Well, right now, policy treats dads as paychecks and not parents. We give non-marital dads almost no rights with regard to their children. They can technically have rights if they can hire a lawyer, but when dads assign child support, there's no automatic process in most places for him to get any kind of visitation, and primary custody of the mother is assumed. So dads feel like they're being treated in a way that's not consistent with their own values. They want to be parents. They want to be nurturers. And until social policy sort of catches up with that reality and helps fathers forge real and lasting bonds with their kids, we're not going to get very far.
And do you think social policy can nurture relationships, Tim?
I think there's a growing recognition, I think, that is part of the solution. And so there are, you know, there's many more fatherhood programs in these neighborhoods than there were when we first started doing the research. And I've been learning a lot more about that. And, you know, I think there's a growing recognition that these guys really do want to be connected with their kids. It's a difficult thing. Because, as you know, as we said, a lot of these guys are no angels. They've been incarcerated. They've, you know, been, you know, on the streets and so forth. And often, you know, the moms are kind of wary about them. So, how to mediate these kinds of relationships is a tough problem.
And we're almost up on a break here, but I'm assuming some basic things like, you know, finishing high school, having usable, sellable skills, so that you can earn a paycheck.
Right. That's, I mean, stable employment is really the basis of a stable family life. And as long as that's not really doable for these guys, it's always going to be just a real problem.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation and our callers, talking with Timothy Nelson and Catherine Eden about their new book called Doing the Best I Can, Fatherhood in the Inner City. Tim Nelson is a lecturer in social policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. Catherine Eden is a professor of public policy also at the Harvard Kennedy School. They are married to each other, and their research focuses on fathers here in the Philadelphia and Camden areas. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
With aortic stenosis, a few steps can leave you breathless. But for many older patients, open-heart surgery is too risky. Now, St. Mary offers a new way, the TAVR technique. Instead of opening the chest, a new valve is threaded through a small incision in the leg. Less trauma, less risk, and faster recovery than open-heart surgery. 215-710-5888. St. Mary Medical Center in Langhorne, supporting WHYY. It's your health. Expect more.
On the next Fresh Air, the reign of King Henry VIII and the beheadings he ordered, including that of his wife Anne Boleyn. We talk with Hilary Mantel, author of the best-selling historical novel Wolf Hall and its sequel Bring Up the Bodies. Each book won the Man Booker Prize, Britain's highest literary honor. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A Michigan man tells us about his brush with death after he ignored his doctor's advice. Also, from those Clark Kent glasses to super cheeseburgers, marketing the Man of Steel. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking about poor dads today on the show. And our guests again are Timothy Nelson, Catherine Eden, co-authors of Doing the Best I Can, Fatherhood in the Inner City. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Bill from Chester County to join us. Bill, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty and guests.
Good morning. Good
morning. Calling from Chester, which of course would be almost a mirror image of Camden, I'm sure, if your study had taken place here.
Right.
Just briefly, though, I hear you speaking on, you know, these dads supposedly with one child and want to be involved. But what have your experience or studies been, or have you run across dads with multiple children from multiple women? And I say that out of not my own personal experience, but from experiences from some young relatives who are, I'll put it this way, they are part of a group of siblings of about 10 to 13 spread amongst four women or more and one father. Now listen off the air. Thanks.
Bill, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Tim, can I toss that to you?
Yeah, sure. Most of the men, especially the older men we talked to, did. We're in that situation, but with far fewer numbers of children. The situation that you describe, I think, is fairly unusual. Most, I think, the father with the most children we talked to had five children, and they were all by the same woman, even though they were not yet married. But this idea of serial fatherhood, which we do talk about in the book, often comes from this dynamic of really wanting to be connected with your kids and then maybe failing at the older ones, but eventually succeeding. And I think that's the part that a lot of people miss, is that these guys do eventually do, as they say in their own words, fatherhood in the right way, and stay connected with their kids and really see them grow up and be part of their lives.
But do you think that's true about all these dads?
Not all of them. I mean, this is what they aspire to, and some make it. Some are in the process. We don't know how their story is turning out because we've talked to them when they're still fairly young. But this is the goal.
Well, and I have to say, reading the book, this is the thing that sort of broke my heart in many ways, because they're telling you, you know, they're aspiring to be good dads, and yet it's so hard for them. And in many cases, not all of them, but in many cases, they either fail or just don't live up to those aspirations.
One of the things that's going on is that these young men are sort of dating as they're having kids rather than having kids after their sort of wild oats are sown, to use their own words. So it gets very, very complicated, and especially from the point of view of the kid. So we used to think that the alternative to a two-parent family was a stable single mother. And we now know from survey research that there are almost no single mothers, no stable single mothers. Instead, both moms and dads are cycling through partnerships. Mm-hmm. So the policy objective of keeping this threesome together is actually very important, because from a child's point of view, the alternative to mom and dad is not stable single mom. It's mom with partner number one, mom with partner number two, dad with partner number one, and half siblings on both sides. So we're creating very complex families, and we're learning that children aren't able to adjust fast enough to all these changes, probably especially boys.
And I mean, does it make sense to try to figure out how to delay parenthood?
Yes. So
even based on what you said about the kind of semi-planning that goes into some of their thinking.
Yeah, right, because older people make better decisions. But men aren't transitioning into stable careers until their late 20s or early 30s. On average, they're having their first child in this demographic group at about 22. So we're talking about a 6 to 8 year gap between when they'll have a stable employment and when they're having kids, if we can move that age at first childbirth up to 25 and improve economic prospects for younger men, maybe we can make some real headway.
Let me see what Anna from, looks like Pleasantville, New Jersey has to say. Anna, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You were talking, Tim, before about the stable employment being a real key factor, and you're actually just referring to that now in a way. And I know that wasn't exactly the focus of your research, but is there, so this is my first question. Is there a role that we can play as members of the village to make, you know, to play a positive role? I mean, like in some places, not so much. I don't think in America people are doing microloans and helping people work out a little job plan. Have you thought about any role that we can play beyond the policy level, but, you know, as nonprofits or whatnot to help with the employment issue?
Anna, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Tim, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a great question. The employment piece is so crucial, I think. And, you know, again, the educational range of these fathers was, you know, mostly on the low end. A lot of these guys had left high school, but some were high school graduates. Some had even done a few years of college and so on. But still, in these neighborhoods that we studied, the employment just wasn't there, particularly stable employment. That's such a tough piece. So a lot of these guys were, you know, they were doing something. As Kathy said before, they often were combining legal, illegal, informal, maybe day labor. But their goal really is to find a stable, well-paying job. And the more, you know, work training and all that stuff is great, but if the jobs aren't there at the other end, it's just such a difficult situation.
Go ahead, Kathy.
So we worked with one nonprofit in Camden called Urban Promise, which has the largest youth employment program in the city, and they hire young people, teenagers, about 100 of them at a time, to work with younger low-income youth in the community. And we were just with some of these kids yesterday. They also help these kids get to college. They follow them through college and make sure they're successful. And some of them come back and give back to the community. Mm-hmm. It's really an amazing model. And there is no reason we can't have more of that. You know, it's amazing. People in this community, it's the Rosedale section of Camden, just flock to this organization. It's like a second home for people. So the role of the nonprofit sector is critical. And I think there's some real examples of hope.
Anna, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. There are some, you know, I would say success stories or people on the road to success. And let me just quote something you say about a guy named Will, an ex-drug dealer with a prison record, no high school diploma, and a history of unstable part-time employment, a father of four who chose to dump his children's mother rather than help her seek treatment in the face of a heroin addiction, may not seem much like a father, but upon closer inspection, there are admirable, even exceptional aspects to Will's efforts as a parent.
Can you expand on that? He's a very interesting guy from the Fairhill section of Philadelphia. And he, you know, given his situation of his kids' mothers, he found some little apartment that he could afford, and he was taking the kids half time. They were all staying with him, and he was working part time. He was one of the few guys really shouldering half of the financial and the parental responsibilities. One of his children had just started kindergarten, was exhibiting some kinds of behavioral difficulties, so he was in the classroom sort of monitoring him for hours and days at a time. So he was really, despite his background and his sort of rough exterior and so on, he was really, in many ways, an exemplary parent.
So what changed for him? Do you know?
I think a stint in prison kind of
really?
Made him make some different decisions. And he just really... he was all about kids. He had a pretty rough upbringing himself, an abusive stepfather, and so on. And as he talked to us, one of his occupational goals was to be either a police officer or a child, you know, guidance counselor, because he just really was concerned with the kids in his neighborhood and just wanted to help out.
Part of what turned Will around, in addition, was the fact that he got a chance because Lori, the children's mother, had a heroin addiction. And so in some ways, her attempts to gatekeep when she got a new boyfriend fell apart. And she had to give him 50% of the load. In fact, I think when we stopped, we the last time we saw Will, he was in the process of getting the kids full time. So there were no impediments to him being a dad.
But you can't build a policy out of that, right? I mean, if we're trying to figure out how to help these dads and help their children and bring some stability to these relationships, you can't use Will's story, or can you?
Well, you can in a way, because there are so many impediments, some of which are policy-driven, which keeps dads from their kids. The presumption that these men are only good for paychecks and not as parents is the root of the problem. There's a lot we can do to change that fairly simply within the law. You can have co-parent courts where dads are guaranteed a role in their kids' lives. They're doing that in some cases in Minnesota. It's a really interesting model.
Reading your book and even talking to you, I was thinking about just the importance of attachment. When it comes, I mean, this is a psychological idea. I mean, I think it's a reality about attachment and human development, and how if you have attachment, that helps, that just, it becomes the kind of basis for almost everything else that you can build on that attachment.
That's exactly right. Attachment is all over the stories, or mostly, unfortunately, disattachment. And that's the tragedy with these guys, is that they're not connected to any institution or relationship the way that they want to be. And we know from psychology and sociology that it's these attachments which keep you not only psychologically healthy, but productive, you know, goal-oriented members of society.
Let me get back to our callers, and it looks like we have Jerry from Easton, Maryland. And Jerry, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Yes, hello, this is Jerry.
Hi, Jerry, go ahead.
I'm calling because I work on a psychiatric unit, and I also work in an outpatient. Also, been a personnel manager in my past, so it's kind of, and I love the idea of the book. It's a book I'm going to buy right away. What I wanted to say was this. On the psychiatric unit, men absolutely who come from poor backgrounds generally, who have become detached from their children, more than that, I would say that is usually their primary issue. It has been sublimated to others because there's nothing they feel they can do about it. They feel truly hopeless. They have very little way of getting back to have a relationship with their children and eventually give up. They honestly despair that, I think, more than anything else. And I think it's a major cause of depression in men. On top of that, some of the systems that we have in our society don't really help. The majority of therapists are women. Your teachers are women. And so these boys that grow up, they grow up without a lot, not only of attachment, but with a lot, without a role model to really gain some perspective from.
Well, Jerry, I know I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and Catherine, you had a kind of visible response to his call.
So, again, in Camden yesterday, we were talking with one of our, one dad, Joe White, and he was telling us about when he was in prison and how virtually every inmate was obsessed with his or her child and had pictures of his or her children displayed in the cell and agonized about visitation because they were so ashamed for their kids to see them in prison but so desperate to see them. Jerry, this is really, really interesting, and I think you've opened up a whole new conversation. Sometimes we think, well, are these men good for the children? But what we also need to think about is, you know, what are these men going to be like without them?
And what are these children going to be like without them, too?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, he described, and Jerry, thanks for calling into Radio Times. I mean, he talks about, and he's in a psychiatric unit, but nonetheless, the kind of mourning that he sees these men going through, and then kind of detaching, giving up.
Right. The role of hope is just so crucial here. And that's what, you know, one reason the men are so excited about a pregnancy is that it's a child is pure potential. If, you know, it, how no matter how badly he may have failed his older children, there's an excitement and an optimism about what the new child might represent, and hope mm-hmm. is so crucial. Over the city of Camden, of course, is inscribed in the city hall, "Without a vision, the people perish." And, you know, just looking out over the desolation of Camden is such a poignant reminder of how we all need this hope and meaning which these children provide.
About a minute before I have to say goodbye, earlier this year at his State of the Union speech, President Obama said this about fatherhood: what makes you a man isn't the ability to conceive a child, it's the courage to raise one. And Kathy, if you could talk to President Obama, I mean, what would you say to him?
I'd say he has the diagnosis wrong. It's not about a lack of courage. Right, it's about a lack of opportunity. If only we could be more empathetic with these guys. If only we could be more sympathetic to their very human need for hope. Maybe we could get further.
And have some of these guys read your book?
Some of them have read our book, and we've had a very good response.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you very much, Marty.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. Timothy Nelson, Catherine Eaton, our guests today on Radio Times, and we have been talking about their new book called Doing the Best I Can, and it's subtitled Fatherhood in the Inner City and the Two Inner Cities where they did their research in Philadelphia and also in Camden, New Jersey. Catherine Eaton is a professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. Timothy Nelson, a lecturer in social policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, email, archives, podcasts, Sirius Satellite Radio. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. And do say